From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The state of our democracy is in deep trouble. And Donald Trump's Electoral College victory in 2016 is not the only indicator. A deeply disliked president and his radical party passed a tax reform bill that was so unpopular and so openly skewed to benefiting the wealthy few over the rest of us that we as a nation need to assess how our government is functioning. The best approach to doing this, according to my guest Francis Moore LaPay, is to understand the notion of democracy itself and to view the actions of Trump and his party as deeply anti-democratic. In her new book, co-written with Adam Eichen, Frances Moore LaPay offers concrete examples of how undemocratic the current status quo is and how we can revive our democracy. The book is called Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning and Connection for the America We Want. LaPay is the co-founder of Food First and the Small Planet Institute. She's the author or co-author of 19 books about world hunger, living democracy, and the environment, beginning with the 3 million copy-selling Diet for Small Planet in 1971. I spoke with her recently about her new book, Daring Democracy. Welcome to the program, Frances Moore LaPay.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. You know, I really liked the fact that you framed your book using the idea of democracy and spending the first part of the book talking about how conservatives, Republicans, etc., have really had a anti-democracy project as, as this framework for their assaults. Because we don't hear it framed often enough. They talk about small government, they talk about libertarianism, but really, effectively, that translates into being anti-democratic. So how do you make your case to somebody who leans conservative that the people in power, particularly the president and those who control Congress, have really taken on an anti-democratic agenda?
Well, I think the first case I have to make is that democracy is essential. And I define it, Adam Eichen, my co-author, and I define it as three fundamental ingredients. And that is the wide dispersion of power so that it's very inclusive. We all have some, we all have a voice. So number one, dispersion of power. Number two, that there is transparency in public relationships, not secrecy as we have today. And three, that there is a culture of mutual accountability. That means that we're all responsible. One great thinker said, some are guilty, but all are responsible. So it's that culture of mutuality that is essential, not the blame game we have today. So we start out just with what we think is pretty obvious, that throughout our history, when power is highly concentrated, when things are secret, and when we partake of this blaming culture, then humanity goes downward. And we do the most brutal, almost unthinkable things to one another. Just think of the Holocaust as one particularly horrific example. So for us, the democracy is not a choice in the sense that, oh yeah, we can do this or that. No, we know enough about who we are that democracy is essential. And so the reason this book is really about, you know, our whole entire future is that starting in the 1970s, there has been ongoing, very successful attempt to convince us that we don't need those three things. And that in fact, government, which is the way we all have an equal voice, democratic government, is not really useful. There, as you know, there has been this attack on the whole notion that government has an essential role to play. And we start this. We are not conspiratorialists, let me say that first of all, but we do recognize that in 1971 there was a very important beginning moment, and that was for this anti-democracy project, as you put it, and that was the composition and the distribution of a memo that was written for the Chamber of Commerce, spelling out what became kind of a playbook. This was someone who, written by someone who became a Supreme Court Justice, his name is Lewis Powell, no longer with us, but he laid out in a 34-page memo, you know, just what are the steps. And so we just try to help the Americans understand that we did not get to this anti-democracy place with now the Trump administration. We didn't get there by accident, that there were very serious steps of unleashing a private wealth into control of our political system, of rigging the rules so that fewer people can vote. The people who would be most opposed to this anti-democratic project would be inhibited from voting. And there are a number of these very specific strategies that have worked, unfortunately.
And so Lewis Powell cast his memo within the framework of wanting to promote free enterprise. And this is really
exactly
critical, right? Because there is the power of capital and then the power of people. And those can often be in conflict. And many, you know, the Democrats would like to think that the power of capital strengthens democracy, and the Republicans might think that the power of capital is more important than democracy. I mean, you can sort of look at it in various ways. But the fact is that when you unleash corporate power, when you unleash the power of wealth, you necessarily dim and damage democracy and the power of people. And I think that's a critical thing for us to kind of get and have a cultural mindset around, right?
Absolutely. And we, you know, you can measure this, that today less than half of 1% of us control the two-thirds of the funding, supply two-thirds of the funding in our political, in our elections. Mm. Now, that gives them tremendous advantage over the rest of us, because they, who gets to run in primaries, who then is ultimately elected, it's a very tiny percent of us who supply the funding for this. And so that's just one piece. And of course,
and you're talking about campaign finance reform and how
campaign
the Citizens
finance,
United
yeah.
decision by the Supreme Court made it even worse. Yeah.
Yes, the Citizens United decision in 2010, what the main effect it had was to unleash independent spending, and that is outside of political parties. So it greatly reduced the accountability of political parties. That's the real crisis here. Independent spending between 08 and 16 increased fourfold. It's an enormous increase in what is called independent spending, which much of it is undisclosed, the secret money. So this diminishes then the sense of accountability, because if you don't know who's, you know, who's funding that, what interest do they have? What is their mindset they're pushing? Is it or is it not in the interest of me, the citizen? So our voices are diminished, and the essence of democracy is equal voice, that we there is political equality, and this money-driven system denies that. So there, that is one piece. But another dramatic shift since that memo of 1971 that equated, you know, business success with freedom for all, which is an anti-democratic view. One measure is that the firms that have lobbying in Washington, the number increased, I believe, something like 14-fold just in the first decade or so after this Powell memo. So lobbying is another largely invisible to most of us, but very, very important aspect of how policy is made, so that political scientists studying who has influence in Washington concluded it, looking over the 80s and the 90s, and it's even more so today, they said that the average citizen has, quote, near zero influence on public policy.
And so that third aspect of the three-pronged approach you were saying on about having democracy thrive, mutual accountability among citizens, it seems like there's a lot of mutual accountability between corporate power and government, not as much between government and citizens, right?
That's a great way of putting it, But part of that, yes, the mutual accountability is the idea that, you know, for all that we are very alarmed at the concentration of power, and it's important to point the fingers at those who are really fomenting this mindset and the rigging of the rules, we go through very carefully showing how the rules have been shifted to help silence people. But it's also important to understand that we can't just point fingers. we citizens, we are now coming together. And so most of our book, and we're very happy to say this, most of our book, over 60%, is about solutions. It's about
right.
the rising democracy movement, that first time in my life that people are coming together across issues, across cultures in our society, and standing up for democracy itself. And this is the most exciting thing in my life right now.
So your book also has a chapter entitled Bringing Down the Thought Barriers. And I alluded to this earlier, this idea of how we frame things. How important is that? Because we do need this cultural mind shift. And I feel like it's already begun. For example, we know among millennials, the idea of socialism is more popular than ever before. We know that Americans get at a very gut level that something's deeply wrong in government. Maybe that we're still sort of lacking a class consciousness. So how important is it for us to frame our ideas, frame what we see is being done to our democracy, and frame what we need to do to take back democracy?
Well, I say it's all important, because my motto is believing is seeing. You know, we hear the frame of seeing is believing. No, but if we don't believe in the possibility of democracy, we will not see it arising. And so we have to reclaim the language of democracy, that freedom, you know, it's been taught to us, it's been sold this idea that freedom is freedom from government. But we say, no, freedom is not get out of my way. Freedom is I have a say, that I have a real say in my future. That is empowerment. So this reframing of the challenge that, that yes, democracy can work as citizens stand up and demand that money is out and citizens are in. And so we tell the story of, you know, the state of Maine, for example, where people are coming together and have since 1996, and then were able to implement in the year 2000, a different way of electing people. And so that you could run for office. I tell the story of a waitress in a small town who could run and be elected then and reelected five times, because she was able to get public financing, because she was able to show that she had the support of her community and run and without private wealth behind her. So I just want to keep coming back to this reframe. Absolutely is absolutely essential. And I think this, the greatest fear I have now is that people are in despair, because they feel
right.
that they don't have a vision of democracy that works. And I think that we've learned now throughout history and seen what other countries have done much more successfully, sidelining powerful moneyed interest, and there is no perfect democracy for sure, but we do know that it is possible, and now more and more states are stepping up to redo the rules, and the whole idea of democracy as a way of life is something that is rewarding, because it is the human need to feel that we count and we do have a say.
So strengthening our democracy doesn't just involve cultural shift, it also involves strengthening the tools of democracy, such as, I mean, it's shocking that in 2018 we would be talking about voting rights, but the fact is that we still have a situation in this country, and it's getting possibly worse, where those people who actually want to vote, because convincing people to vote is not always easy, but those people actually want to vote are often discouraged because of strict so-called voter ID laws that many feel are more akin to voter suppression laws. The idea of how the Republicans have managed to, and some even in some cases even Democrats, use redistricting to pervert Democratic representation. These very basic tools, these very basic sort of mechanisms by which our democracy is supposed to work, are broken at some level, right?
Absolutely. And this, again, intentional in the sense that by, say, voter ID, as you mentioned, that you think, oh, well, that's kind of logical. Wait a minute. We have many ways to ensure, and there's never been a problem with people falsifying themselves when they go to vote. That is not non-issue. But by requiring that people have ID, it's very clear that it does effectively, it affects poor people. It affects people of color who have much less time, much less transportation available to them. And so the people who are putting forward these, and now have so many states have introduced these laws, that they know who they're disadvantaging. The people who would be most opposed to this idea that government, you know, is your enemy, the people who would want to ensure that we're stepping up for, you know, basic decent pay, for example, and all the things that, you know, college education that's affordable, healthcare that's affordable, these basic things that make quality of life good, then the people who are most care about that, people at the edge, are the ones most disenfranchised by voter ID requirements, by reducing the number of polling places, by, you know, a number of restrictions like that, including felon disenfranchisement, which is a huge factor in our country. We're one of the very few countries in the world that in many places deny people the right to vote even after they have paid their time for their offense. And now there's a lot of pushback on this because, of course, we all benefit if people who have, you know, have paid for their wrongdoing are reintegrated in society and feel like dignified citizens. And so there are now efforts, again, I want to keep focusing on this, on re-establishing democracy.
Francis, how important is it for us while we are trying to have a cultural shift in our thinking about democracy for us to clearly identify the anti-democratic forces? Because I feel that it can help us fire up our inspiration. It can fire up the imagination by having a different mindset when it comes to the super rich in America. And I don't mean to say we should all hate the rich, but we should ask how much money is enough for a rich person. We should ask, what is the end game of the Koch brothers? The fact that, you know, they have this organization, Americans for Prosperity, which is just such a bizarrely worded title that basically is, you know, rights for the rich. How important is it for us to point that out and remind ourselves that these are the people that are subverting our democracy to their end because they are so greedy, they just feel like $10 billion isn't enough. They need a trillion.
Right. I just read the figure that three Americans control more wealth than the bottom half of us. And I just want to stick with the Koch brothers for a moment because we learned in writing this book that the Koch network, the political network, again, it's largely invisible, that it is about 3.5 times larger than the Republican National Committee and its congressional election arms.
Wow.
That's huge. 70% of the resources of the right now are outside of the party structure. And again, we want to underscore that means they're even more invisible, less accountable.
And they have a lot of leverage then over the party outside the party.
Absolutely.
The Republicans made it clear, right, when they were trying to pass their tax bill, our donors want us to do this. They've kind of let it slip many times.
I know. It's interesting. The first, I may be wrong, but in press reports, I've heard now in this, you know, last few months, people talking about what the donors want. And I think at least that's some exposure, that's some progress of identifying that force. But I really think that's so important. For example, you mentioned earlier Citizens United, that decision that 80% of us disliked because it unleashed independent corporate money in our elections. Well, most people do not know what was behind that. What was behind that is the DeVos family. Betsy DeVos, now Secretary of Education, worked for 15 years on a lawsuit with a particular lawyer that they backed, James Bopp, and got it all the way to the Supreme Court. This is Amway money, this huge marketing colossus of this incredible wealthy family, the DeVos family. So again, these things didn't just happen out of nowhere. And I think when you say it's important for us to understand the role of this very small number of people, it's not to be conspiratorialist or just blaming. It's to understand that this just didn't happen because Americans wanted it to happen. It happened for very self-interested reasons of people who really believe that, I think they really believe that somehow it's better if the rich get richer. It's certainly better for them. And so I think most Americans would agree that that kind of inequality I just alluded to, we can't possibly have a functioning society like that
And we
because we
can't
end up,
compete with it, right? I mean,
we
if we
can't,
want to compete with
exactly.
it, it means having more money on our side, which, by the time you get that money, you're on their team anyway, because then money is pushing your interests. So the only way to counter that level of money and greed is, of course, through people power and through saying, no, the government is important and it's important for it to be accountable to us.
Yes, I want to just mention here the whole thing of blaming globalization for people in America losing their manufacturing jobs. Well, again, I want to come in and say, yes, there's a force of globalization, but it doesn't have to ruin us if we had a government accountable to us. For example, why did Germany, compared to the US, have one third as big a share of its manufacturing jobs go away with economic globalization? Why do their workers in manufacturing make so much more than American workers in Germany? Well, one of the reasons they have a system in which workers actually participate on corporate boards, and they have a system that doesn't allow money to dominate as much, nearly as much as ours. So I just wanted to underscore that often things like the loss of manufacturing jobs are laid at the feet of sort of these big forces that we can't control, but no. That if we have democracy answering to us, we can figure out solutions that protect the well-being of regular people. And so they won't be so angry then that they would want to vote for a Donald Trump just to kind of throw a wrench into the mix. So I think we have to understand that the anger that has come out of this is understandable.
So looking forward to 2018, there are a lot of people who are trying to fight the despair that they're feeling, and want to see a way out of the morass. Do you think that reviving the idea of democracy, participation in a democracy, democracy as a voice in our own country, can undermine that despair, can lift
I
it?
think it can dissolve it with something very powerful, and that is what we call in our book, Daring Democracy. We call it the thrill of democracy. That, we buy this, again, the mindset that democracy is a dull duty. We have to eat our spinach to get our dessert of personal freedom. But
Oh
wait a
dear,
minute.
I think I've put it
What
in
we've.
those terms sometimes.
Yes, we learn that. But what Adam and I learned as we wrote this book,
Your
as we,
co-author,
you
Adam
know, met,
Aiken, yeah.
Adam Aiken and I met. And we got to be friends. What? How? Because we marched together from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. And when you walk, you talk. I thought people would be wearing earbuds, but no, we were all talking. And it was a life-changing experience because we discovered what we then, Adam and I, call in our book, we call the thrill of democracy, which means the joy of bonding with strangers. So you don't feel like some oddball, you know that you can bond with people even with different backgrounds around this core value of democracy. The thrill of discovering that we are owners of this democracy. As we walked into Washington and saw the Capitol building, we had this moment where we said, oh my gosh, oh, it's ours. It doesn't belong to them, those folks in those buildings. We're the citizens. We own our democracy.
And
And
that feeling
that
can't be
feeling
manufactured or seen in photos. It really has to be felt in person, right?
Yes, and so, but I just want to underscore more than anything that to enrich our lives, not because we should, this heavy duty on our shoulders, but because feeling powerless is really awful. There's nothing worse for, humans evolved as doers. We did things. We wouldn't be to this complex world unless we were doers. And so I just welcome all who are listening that, really, this is not the dull burden. It is the essence of the good life. And so we're creating a website and we want people's help to make it really exciting. It's called Field Guide to Democracy is the URL, but it's going to become this very interactive website. Field Guide to the Democracy Movement is what it really is, where you can find, there's going to be a map there where you can find what's going on where you are, and it's not there, but if you contact us through that site and want to help us out to make it exciting and a place where we can all feel that thrill of democracy.
And we'll post a link to that from our website later today. Francis Moore-Lapay, I have one last question for you. In the 70s, your book, Diet for Small Planet, sold millions of copies. You wrote it in the 70s. It sold millions of copies later. You were one of the earliest sort of thinkers and pioneers about the sort of food politics movement. And yet here you are today writing a book about democracy and reclaiming democracy and sort of reviving it. Can you sort of explain that journey briefly? Did your work with the Small Planet Institute lead you to this moment where you went from thinking about how the world feeds itself to how democracy works?
Yes, it's really one question. I started saying within a decade after Diet for a Small Planet was published, I was saying, you know what? Democracy, excuse me, you know what? hunger is not caused by a scarcity of food. Mm. It's caused by a scarcity of democracy. Hmm. And so much of my life has been trying to figure out what do I mean by that? Because I knew in my gut what I meant, that it's about voice, it's about power, but I really have decided now, and I've written a number of books about democracy and had an organization focused on democracy, and
right.
I'm really now excited and totally committed to devoting the rest of my life to this foundational question, because it's underneath everything from climate change to racial justice to overall inequality, all of these questions. We can't solve any of them without democracy, as a lived experience, not just some, as I say, dull duty that we do four times, every 4 years. No, no, no. We're talking about citizens realizing that this is who we are. This is what human beings, we need power, we need connection, and we need a sense of purpose. Those are the three essentials for human thriving, and democracy is the expression of those.
And those in power understand that the greater and stronger our democracy is, the more they have to share power, the less power they get to hoard. So they get it. And it's up to us, of course, to get that idea as well. Francis, thank you so much for spending this time with us. Really appreciate all the work you do.
Thank you. It's been delightful to meet Sonali.
My guest has been Francis Moore-Lapay, the co-founder of Food First and the Small Planet Institute. She's the author or co-author of 19 books about world hunger, democracy, and the environment. She first became famous in 1971 when she published her book, Diet for a Small Planet, that went on to sell 3 million copies. We've been discussing her newest book, co-authored with Adam Eichen. It's called Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.